It's the middle of the month, and you know what that means.
You finally got sick of Emily, and now I get to be your plucky young sidekick?
No, it's time for a slightly delayed episode of Allopod. This month, we're in Seattle with Jethro and Bo of Throbo Show, and Andrew Burton stops by to read his technology haiku. That's all ahead on Allopod, but first, Joe Seibel with Hot Sexy Girls.
Every time I see you, I get locked inside my room. It's like someone presses buttons and all I see is you. It's like the tender demolition of a matchstick man when the air is unconditioned by a plastic fan. Hot sexy is what I need. Describe the view, it's like someone presses buttons and all I see is you. It's like the thunder of ignition when you start to move and dance in your rattlesnake boots and your black leather pants. Hot sexy is what I need.
The song, it's Hot Sexy Girls.
The California remix.
I thought you hired strippers.
It'd
be like Howard Stern going on.
It would have been. I have to crank the bass way up for that. I don't have the right kind of microphones. I can't do it. Anyway, we're here live with Throbo Show. The guys from Throbo Show here. And we have Jethro and Bo. How's it going, guys?
Going great.
It's going great. Good to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. We actually talked about Throbo Show a little while back. I had Chris on.
Shamelessly plugging, yes.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's as I said then, that's what this show is all about, shamelessly plugging stuff. But no, we're here in Seattle this month, and unfortunately, Emily's not with us. She's back in Spokane. Cheney, probably. But no, I'm here, and we're here. Chris is our guest host this month. So Jethro and Bo, here to plug Throbo Show once again. You have your first episode is out on your website, which we'll have a link to in the show notes. And so we had a few questions for you, so you can tell us a little bit about the show. The first question I had is, how did you come up with the idea for Throbo Show?
Well, I think Jethro and I have been best friends since we were 10 years old, and it's been our pastime to just come up with ridiculous skits and scenarios and just we've been fleshing them out throughout our 25-plus-year friendship.
Wild, ridiculous fantasy sessions.
And it's so good to have Chris and Lindy to put it into reality or into some kind of format where we can foist it upon the public.
Yeah, we should probably have the disclaimer in there that you're the a big part of the production, Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not just a plucky young sidekick.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that greatly explains why.
I have a chair with director written on it.
Yeah, that greatly explains why you whore the show so much.
Yes, yes, yeah. I was the director. Lindy, my wife, is the producer. As First Sight Productions, we put the show together and made it. I was going to come up with some biblical thing, but we made it. So
you made it epic.
We're just amazed that they attached their name to it at all.
But shocked, really.
Thankful.
Well, yeah, for anybody who's seen the show, I was running Jethro an email a while back, and I was like, you know, we're legitimately trying to build a business plan out of awesome deep throat bathroom head, and, you know, my parents have had interesting things to say about that, too, but yeah.
Yeah, what did your parents think?
Well, they really, really like Win-Win. They think that's awesome. But yeah, they took me out to breakfast the other morning and sat me down and had this conversation about how what I'm doing as an artist has permanence, and anyone at any time could pull this up, and they were thinking of Baby Pool and Sandbox and how I might not be proud of it in 5 years, and how they were offended. And
it's kind of like that little, you know, Superman tattoo in college.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But I mean, that it is a pretty forward sketch, to say the least. And the question that Chris's parents had, I know you told me the story earlier, was why did you go there? So why did you go there?
We just wanted to plunge deep into our psyches and pull out something funny.
Well, and also, it's just, the comical part of it is just the absurdity of a couple of filthy bums talking about their sexual conquests and just having it build and become more and more absurd throughout the skit. So, you know, it's based on a comedic concept anyway.
And I just think the 60-plus demographic apparently is not in tune with that idea.
With anal fisting and...
Oddly enough, you know,
Chris's parents obviously aren't well-versed in anal fisting. At least they're not admitting to that.
Maybe that's why they were just so deeply offended.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God.
It's hitting too close to home.
Kind of felt like they were found out right. or something.
They're not going to be listening to this, are they? We got to edit that out.
We're gonna edit this out, okay. Thomas, right? Yeah.
Actually, if you listen to our last podcast, we talked all about how people say, oh, I'm going to edit that out, and then never do.
Yeah, right.
They don't have an iPod.
Okay. Oh, well, because as we all know, iPods are the only medium with which you can listen to a
podcast.
That's
right. Well, it does require knowing how to use a computer, too. So.
Oh, I'm so glad.
That's saying a lot for your parents.
Your parents are not going to like this interview.
Speaking of permanence.
Oh. Yeah, Chris might be permanently out of the will after this. Exactly.
You know, it'll be 10 years down the road, I'll be on an episode of Leno, and he'll be like, so, I've got this tape there, you want your parents to listen to this? And I'll be like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then he'll pull this out of the... Yeah, oh, yeah. Good times.
Good times.
So you guys were saying that you've known each other since you were 10. What were the circumstances surrounding your meeting? Like, when did you meet, how, where, that sort of thing?
We were at Stober Elementary School in Applewood, Colorado, and...
Suburb of Denver,
Colorado. And we had a mutual best friend, and he was actually kind of a dick. And it turned out that he left the scene. We still hung out.
Well, I remember when I first met Jethro, we were at the same silent reading table together.
Something I'm not very good at.
Yeah. And with this girl, Bonnie Miller. And so was a fairly avid reader as a kid. And it was really hard to read with him talking nonstop.
And I was a
flirting shamelessly with Bonnie Miller. But inevitably, I picked up on how funny he was. And then I think our friendship really blossomed out of that. And then Trevor, who was our other friend, yeah, we got rid of him.
got him out before that.
Got him out of there.
A larger profit margin that way.
That's right. That's right.
More
Robo Trev. Yeah. It doesn't rhyme.
And, you know, we wanted to be a comedy duo, not a trio.
So where do you get the inspiration for a lot of your sketches, for all of your sketches, I suppose?
Just riffing. It's really like jazz.
Insofar as you walk in with no idea of what you're going to do,
smoke some pot,
we just feel kind of oppressed, you know. We just try to get out our art through, you know, disgusting monologues.
It just happens. We can't even help it. It's just like diarrhea. It just happens.
Wouldn't it be more like logorrhea?
Yes. Yes.
That's actually, oddly enough, like, that's actually how we shot a lot of the sketches as well, was a very like improv. Yes. Well, I actually had diarrhea throughout most of the production, so.
Literally and figuratively.
Well, no, like, we would come in and it would be a very improvisational style, which was obviously kind of difficult to shoot from a, like, a structural standpoint, but it worked out really well, I think, especially in sketches like Win-Win.
See, some people call that disorganized or unprepared. We call it improvisation.
But I mean, you shut up. But do you find that to be, like, beneficial for the type of comedy it is? Do you think it works well with that medium?
Sometimes. I mean, you know, this first episode was definitely a learning experience, and oftentimes it worked for us. I think sometimes it was detrimental to us. In some sketches, you know, the wardrobe, for instance, wouldn't line up from one shot to the other, which was unfortunate, but, you know, that's okay. And but yeah, I think it worked out mostly for the better because we got really good ideas on set. But it's kind of interesting. We were talking earlier about just the nature of shooting comedy and how often it's easier on set to shoot comedy than drama because everyone's in a great mood and everyone's just gelling with each other and the ideas are going. And then you get into the edit suite and you're like, oh, shit, what have we done? It seems so good at the time, but it actually you know, that's the beauty of editing. You know, whatever is not good out of the improvisation, you can just remove entirely. So, no biggie.
And boy, did he do a lot of editing.
There's actually a lot more funny, or there's a lot more crap that we didn't see.
I don't know.
We
have some secret hidden episodes.
Yeah?
Lying around.
Yeah, there's some.
There's going to be bonus material on a DVD later on.
Yes, there will. Oh. Easter eggs, if you will.
Easter eggs. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. We know about Easter eggs.
Yeah. Well, I like the improvisational thing because it seems like a lot of the shows that I really enjoy, like Curb Your Enthusiasm, and, you know, there's just a loose kind of script idea and certain lines that he wants in there, but he kind of lets the actors go with it, and then you end up with something.
Well, that's how Christopher Guest does pretty much all of his films.
Exactly. Like,
here's the goal, get there.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. As long as you
and
have
those turn out quite well.
As long as you have actors who are controlled enough to do that. And a group of people who can work well enough to do that, I think. And that's what we have. I mean, you know, at first it may not have been like that, but now, I mean, we're definitely a team that works very, very well together.
Playing off of each other.
Exactly.
Being able to read each other ahead of time.
And it's weird, like, doing that with a camera in your hand, it's kind of an interesting experience. Because I'm not in, well, I guess I'm in one of the sketches, but just from, like, a directorial standpoint, having an improvisational input is kind of interesting. So
why don't you take us through the process of writing and shooting a sketch?
Well, usually Bo and I are drinking with a piece of paper and a pen.
Yep.
And then one of us makes a joke, the other just writes it down.
Is there scheduled time for this?
Usually what happens, we're drinking, no scheduled time.
This is improv as well, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
And we just come up with ideas. I usually do the writing part, which is bad because I've got horrible handwriting. So then
it's very
that's another
doctorly.
Yeah. And then somehow we type it into some form and yeah, then we sort of do away with that, and Chris tells us we're doing everything wrong. And then it's pretty much how it works.
And there's, you know, this weird quiet tension between us, all of us.
So once you've got it written out as a script, then what? I think Lindy, the producer, probably has something to say about the next part, right? I mean, your job kind of comes up next, getting things organized.
Well, true, and being the only female usually on set, I've become kind of the den mother, so to speak, and
what is this, Cub Scouts now?
Yeah, well, you know, yelling at people who don't know their lines, where the improv really comes in because they have not rehearsed their scripts that they so feverishly wrote. That's
never happened.
Lies, all of them lies.
But yeah, basically, it's just because it's so much fun to be on set, but yet. Being four people that have day jobs, we have to do it on weekends, nights, anytime that we possibly have free. And so we only have a few hours or half a day. So just really keeping it focused is the hardest part.
How about like trying to find locations and props and wardrobe?
We've been really lucky this first time. We did, luckily, Jethro moved like three times, I think. So we had like three different apartments to shoot in.
I'm unstable.
And he also changed jobs like four or five times. So
five.
We had a lot of locations ready for us.
This might be another one of those permanency things. Maybe we should cut all that out.
Don't forget Laura.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. We had a great costume designer that kind of came in. Kind of around the beginning that Jethro met, and she just helped us so much, especially with the baby pool and sandbox sketch. And so we just really met.
And Dismerriment as well.
Dismerriment as well, yes. Really the hardest location to get was the cemetery for Dismerriment, because when you're shooting in a cemetery, you have to be really careful not to shoot names. And plus, we were doing some pretty vulgar things to
like licking tombstones.
Yeah, and you have to be careful that there's no relatives nearby. Luckily, though, we found an entire part of a cemetery that had no one buried.
Oh, so Chris, I know you wanted to give us some of the technical details of how you shoot it and what you use and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. So we shoot on the mini DV format because it's cheap and easy to light. And we shoot with a DVX-100, which is the greatest camera in the world. And it's all edited on a Mac, which is great. They make it nice and easy with Final Cut Pro. So, which actually, anyone in the Seattle area, I know Thomas is doing a contest. Reminder that you can win tickets to a show during SIFF.
Plug.
Yes, but I will actually be teaching classes in Final Cut Pro at SIFF, so keep your eye out for that, the Apple Portable Classrooms. Yeah. We should really have a plug tag that we can
Yeah. End plug now. So where do you guys want to go from here? Where do you hope Throwba Show ends up?
Oh, man, we'll just take whatever we can get.
I was hoping the hearts and minds of millions across the globe.
That's right. No, we want to go all the way.
Laughing's probably not the best. No,
that's always a good sign.
We want it to be just a multimedia explosion.
Explosion. That's the word you're going with, explosion.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking more of like a multimedia diuretic explosion. No,
there we go.
Okay, I got to put in those terms.
Handicapped, handlebar, gripping, good. Yeah.
I think the best scenario for us would be to actually be on a television show on cable, so we could be pretty randy, but actually have a studio budget. And
we need your money. Send us your money.
We need, yeah.
Cool.
And have, you know, set designers and just be able to really go berserk would be great.
So what happens if it doesn't get picked up? Well, I mean, like, what happens if there's like a negative response?
What do you mean?
Well, you
is
know,
there a contingency
dude,
plan?
You are a party pooper.
God.
Well, I mean, there's
where's
no
the puffball question, dude?
Like, how you holding up or
yeah
something?
Come on, yeah, right.
Do you ever see The Decline of Western Civilization 2? They talk to this metalhead. They go, "What if you don't make it?" He's like, "But I will." They go, "But what if you don't?" He's like, "But I will," and he never gives in. And so I feel like that metalhead right now. Otherwise, you know, I'll just go to my day job.
Yeah. Speaking of which, what are your day jobs?
Funny you should ask. I am a software solutions engineer.
That sounds like a bunch of bullshit. What do you do?
That's what it says on the card. I build websites.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Okay.
So like web dev. All right.
Web dev. Exactly. And my other
plug
job.
Your band.
Oh, I got a plug. And then I have other creative pursuits. I love walking on the beach. I call my family every week.
Jethro is single, all you ladies out there.
Yeah.
He's hot.
And guys.
He's hot.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, don't. God! Stop it.
I thought we were plugging things.
Plugging.
Dude.
And what else? And then I also have a band called Guardian Ear, which is just an all-acoustic ensemble that will be gigging out here shortly, next couple months in Seattle.
How about you? What do you do?
I'm a service industry slug. I've been a bartender for quite a few years. Got two bartending gigs now. and I'm in the local band, The Bad Things. And we just got finished with our second CD. Vaudeville Show.
Excellent band, excellent disc.
Yeah, and I'm a writer as well, which is, you know, dovetails nicely with Throwba Show.
What sort of stuff do you write?
Fiction, yeah, satirical fiction.
Brutally sarcastic fiction.
Any examples you could compare yourself to give a good idea?
I think I'm sort of in the school of Joseph Heller and Philip Roth.
Mm.
Yep. That's me.
There it is.
I'm married, a homeowner, so all you ladies.
Thank the wife.
Jethro's single. Oh, I gotta thank my wife, Courtney. She's been very supportive.
Why are we thanking someone on a podcast? I don't know, yeah. But it sounded right. You took the bait, dude.
Hey, man. So, yeah, that's me.
Well, if any marriage can survive Throwba Show, then that's a strong marriage.
That's right? a strong yeah. marriage.
If his marriage can survive me.
How are you guys doing?
Yeah, how are you two doing?
Is your marriage has survived through a show? So
I prefer not it? To talk about
Well, Bo and Jethro, being on set with a married couple, they actually created a song for us.
Oh.
You guys should do the little rendition here.
Public Bicker. Public Bicker.
That's the song. It's called Public Bicker. We've all seen couples do that, haven't we?
Just like, ooh, there they go, a little deeper than they should.
Didn't want to know that.
It's always interesting, too, because it's like, you know, with some production aspect, like focus or the mic or like, you know, just something like that, and all of a sudden it will turn, you know, like Dr. Phil says, into the real problem. Like, you never listen. God. Yeah, that's good.
Crispin.
Actually, no, it's not like that at nice. All. And we're actually very professional on set.
Public Bicker.
Public Bicker. Just when you thought it was going well. Public Bicker.
Public Squabble.
I think I need to get that on a hot key.
Uncomfortable pause.
Massive Quibble.
Massive Quibble.
Uncomfortable pause.
The best part is that Bo and I also quibble like an old married couple.
And it's been pointed out to us
by vast quantities of humans.
So, Chris, we know what your family thinks about the project. What do your guys' families think? Or have they even seen it?
Well, that's a, you know, I don't have a lot of family left. My wife, first time she saw it, was not that into it. And was a little more shocked by how he looked in some of the skits, especially Dismerriment. But the second time, she watched it with a group of people, and she actually really enjoyed it and was laughing. And I think it's better to watch stoned with other people.
So, take note. Light up, kick back with your bows.
How illegal is it to include pot in the DVD if people order it? That's what I want to know.
It's the lowest law enforcement priority in Seattle, I think.
And yep. done.
All right. And done.
Like all these dogs suddenly very interested in your DVD.
Weird.
My family has loved it.
Yeah.
Yep. There's like, you know, you're crazy. So that's good.
And you know, I do have to defend my parents on this one. They do actually, they do like all of it. They were just confused, I guess, by Baby Pool. But no, they actually... Surprisingly enough, you know, they're both over 60 and they got a big kick out of it, which I was actually really pleased to see that we hit, because, you know, we're targeting, you know, like 20 to 40, you know, sort of technologically.
18 to 49.
Yeah, you know that. Yeah.
Generic.
Yeah, people who have jobs where they can go look at things on the internet, that kind of thing right. during the day. And my parents were like, it was awesome. Yeah.
Like me.
My parents saw it and kind of an interesting reaction that they were like, oh, that's nice. Dear. But I don't think my parents have been assimilated into this realm of creative art that I've gone into like the others have. So it's going to take time.
What about people in your demographic that you've shown it to or that you know have seen it? How have they responded? Because, positive. I mean, that's really...
Yeah, overwhelmingly positive.
I mean, we've gotten actually really good constructive criticism mm-hmm. from some people. And for the most part, I really agree with everybody. But, you know, it's our maiden voyage.
Sure.
Our first attempt, and
well, and it's not.
We all can. I mean, especially I think Jethro and I can improve as actors. And
definitely, Bo.
Yeah. And Jethro should really work on his lines a little more before we do the shoot.
Public Baker.
Chris and Lindy were awesome, though.
They were great. Unlike some of the other members of the group.
So we've gotten some constructive criticism, but really for the most part, positive.
At the same time, I don't think it's fair for you to have to compromise your creative vision.
Oh, hell no. I mean, you know, the other thing is we did it on Sunday afternoons with a $100 budget.
Hmm.
We're just doing what we can, and I think it's good. I mean, the whole thing is it funny? That's all we care right. about. Is it funny? That's the vision.
Yep. We actually did do a lot... Like, as much as, you know, going through film school, I always said, oh, God, I'll never do those fucking comment cards that you hand out in malls, you know, for people to watch your movie. But we actually did have people come over and give us feedback and really try and tailor it to what is funny. Because we just want people to laugh. You know, it's like at the end of Sullivan's Travels, you know, that's what he learns. He just wants to make people laugh. And so, but I think it's been good. You know, that whole process was very enlightening to me. And as an auteurist, if excuse the language, but, you know, yeah.
And one good thing is it seems like different people like different skits. I mean, there hasn't been just this, you know, everybody saying, oh, I love that one. I mean, everybody's got their favorite. And so each of the skits has had an appeal for somebody.
Have a fan club.
Which is cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you have a second episode coming out eventually. Do we have an ETA on that one? We can expect to see something else?
No.
And that's my cue. Basically, Chris and I, First Sight Productions, so we, in order to do Throwbo Show, we had to have some kind of deal. And so we said, okay, we'll help you guys do Throwbo Show. You help us with one of our projects. And so our project coming up is a short film that we've been working on. We wrote and we hope to produce this spring. And they are going to be the leads in that. And it's going to be called Collect All Four. So after we get that shot and in the can, we will then start on the next episode of Throwbo Show.
We're excited.
Yeah, so yep. We'll be looking at like after August maybe to start shooting. And yeah, that'll give us time to prepare all the material and get everything good and, you know, good. That's the key word. Yeah.
It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
So you have a bunch of sketches written already?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we have at least two episodes ready to go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, in, you know, just a given hour and a half of Jethro and I hanging out and drinking beers, we can have two more episodes. It's just
you know, you're really fueling the fire for critics. Like, the show is written on beer and improv. What the God?
It's beer and
beer and $100.
Beer and immaturity. Yeah.
Yeah, I think our primary goal is to age gracefully, and that's what Throwbo Show really does for us.
Don't know what that pertains to.
It's had to get that out.
We're just extending our adolescence as long as we possibly can.
So now you're talking about, you know, you said an ideal situation would be to be picked up and put on cable, something like that. Are you doing anything to mitigate that process?
That's, I don't know, is Lindy doing anything?
Basically, right now, we are focusing solely on getting into the Seattle Film Festival. We hope, and we're pretty, we have a, from inside sources, we have a pretty good idea, hopefully, that we're going
to
get
in. You have officially jinxed it. Way to go.
So we're going to get in, and I just know we're going to get in. And then what I'm going to do after that is just start sending it everywhere.
Right.
And start making those contacts, because we have nothing to lose but them to say no.
Right.
And that's basically my marketing plan, is just start whoring out DVDs like someone wanting crack really bad and just needing money. So
that was a fantastic analogy, Lindy. Yeah. Good job there.
I mean, First Sight Productions is basically a crack whore. And that's what that's about.
You know, they've got those those services that search podcasts and they have like text bridges, you know, where it's audio to text, and so you can search for specific things. People are going to search for like crack podcast, and firstsightproductions.com. Good.
We find a vice and we plug it full of chemical substances. Yes.
Yeah, that's why we like them.
I think you're gonna have to change your tagline from "Don't blink" to "Can't blink."
Totally. Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't think I have any other questions for you guys. It's been a humorous 30 minutes or so.
Appreciate you having us on.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming here. And
I got a lot more to say, though.
If you've got more to say, it's an hour-long show.
No, that's more than enough.
When Stu was on the show, did he plug as much as we did?
He had a book. He has a book that he plugged.
Oh, very nice. But which books you want to plug?
I think I plugged the book for him.
Oh, but, nice.
I'd like to plug the August 2005 issue of Hang Gliding Magazine, because I have an article published in it.
Not a joke. Really? Seriously?
Yeah.
Really? I've been working on a book for about 8 years. I'll plug that. It'll be done sometime, I guess.
It's a good book. I've read it. It's awesome.
Jethro's read, yeah.
How many times have you read it?
He, being an author, he's very, he holds it close.
Uh-huh. Holds it close. You know, it'll get out there.
That was one of the better first lines of any book I've ever read. But I won't tell you what it is.
We'll have to wait. See, there you go. That's your hook. Now people... Yes. Now people want to know.
That's right.
Mason Boye Bear, author of The Hidden Book.
It's called Rent Paradise, Inc.
Mm.
on bookshelves soon.
On bookshelves soon.
Thanks for the interview.
Yeah. Hey, anytime.
You give good interview.
That was some sweet interview, dude. Oh.
This has been Throwbo Show. On the way of Jethro and Bo. Thank you guys for coming out here today.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris and Lindy, for answering my questions as well.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, this is C-Jax, and you're listening to Allopod. 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 A life less ordinary.
Andrew, so glad you could actually join us in person this time.
Always my pleasure.
So you have a new haiku for us, right?
Yes, I have a March's haiku.
And what's it called?
It's called Unity.
Unity. You want to go ahead and read that for us?
Sure thing.
Here's Andrew Burton reading this month's haiku, Unity.
Talk long distances. The internet unites us. All faces flat screen.
Yay.
Nice.
While we have you here, I suppose I should ask you a few questions. Well, where do you get the inspiration for these?
Well, I usually just, they're technology themed, and I think of some sort of technological aspect that I've had in my life recently, you know, within the past month. And then I sort of write them, usually goes the last line and then the first line and then the middle, uniting the two.
Why do you do it that way?
Well, I think of what idea I want to convey, and that's usually in the last line, and then it sort of builds up to the punchline.
Cool.
So which how many Allopods have there been?
This will be number 9.
Number 9. Wow.
Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9.
Number 9.
So any trouble coming up with new ideas? I mean, this is the 9th one and could go on for at least 10
episodes.
Yeah,
actually, the biggest problem I think from my end that I've noticed is that I keep forgetting to remind him, like, at the beginning of every month that I need another one. I'm like, okay, I need it now. And so then usually it's like the day before I'm supposed to release the podcast. I'm like, oh, crap, I need that component.
Yeah, I usually have an idea of what I'm going to do for the haiku in advance. But then when you give me the heads up, that's when it really solidifies. Or I'll have just the last line written. Or that usually the whole thing gets rewritten with the same idea each month.
About how long does it take you to come up with them?
15 minutes, maybe.
The beauty of haikus. Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for stopping by and taking some time out of your schedule to come read it live for us here.
No problem.
It's good seeing you again.
All right, now I was told there was pizza here.
There is pizza, and you'll get that momentarily. I think this would be a good time to toss to our second song by Joe Seibel. And that song is called Inspiration of Love. You're listening to it right here on Allopod. That was Joe Seibel with Inspiration of Love right here on Allopod. And if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that we've done the format back to front this week, this month, rather. We did the interview first. Normally, we do that part second. But we were going to talk about some things pertaining to Washington State, mostly. We have the new anti-smoking law that passed recently. Overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
It was like 97-3 or something like that, percentage or something.
I thought it was like 70-30.
Okay, but still, it was like was like a huge percentage, like a landslide percentage of, and which is interesting. And I heard my boss, actually, well, a bunch of people at work smoke, and I've heard some of the smokers say that the reason a lot of smokers voted for it is because they also don't want their clothes stinking like that, and it's, they don't like to sit in an environment where there's a lot of smoke, yet they enjoy smoking, which I found was odd. But
I won't try and rationalize that
I don't know.
Yeah, and they recently just added on, I guess it was last week. Well, okay, so when this airs, it'll be that now, like, even bus stops, like covered bus stops, count as a public indoor location. So you have to stand 25
even though they only have like one wall.
Yeah, well, you know, what are you gonna do? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting, like, as a non-smoker and as someone who is, you know, frankly sick and tired of going to bars and coming out smelling like smoke, or just not going out anywhere because of fear of smoke, smelling. Yeah. You know, it's like, basically, I had to wait till I was 21 to enjoy live music generally.
Right.
And now it just is an unpleasant experience as a result of the smokers. So on the one hand, I'm all in favor for it, but on the other, it feels like a pretty hardcore invasion of rights.
Well, it's one of those things too, like, you know, if they're taking this away from certain people, what are they going to take away from me in the future? Like, is this just like the tip of the iceberg for our rights being taken away from us?
Yeah, there's a kid's book about this, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, when will they come for me? Yeah, I mean, because, you know, the analogy that I've been using is, you know, like, what if they start banning junk food? Because, sure, there's no immediate impact of me eating junk food to anyone else. But, you know, if enough of people are doing it, and, you know, with obesity being so high as it is in this country, if enough people are eating bad food, then the healthcare costs go up as a result of people having, you know, heart disease or whatever. And then, you know, people are paying more money in taxes for the fat people. So
maybe those people who are forced to not smoke as much are, you know,
that's right,
helping themselves out by, you know, feeding a different addiction, and cheeseburgers or whatever.
I mean, you know, I mean, we banned alcohol once in this country, and that didn't work.
Yeah, that really didn't work.
But, you know, it seems a lot different now. I mean, it's pretty new to have the ban on smoking, but there doesn't seem to be like a big movement. You know, there's like one bar in Bellingham that is like, fuck this.
Yeah, they're like two bars in Spokane or something like that. They've done the, and actually, I think they just got taken to court about over it.
Yeah, I mean, the Seattle Police Department has publicly said that they are not going to enforce it. Yeah,
Spokane said the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting conundrum.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird when it's like, well, here's the law, but, you know, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
What do you do then?
It's weird, too, just being, like, philosophically opposed but personally attracted to the same legislation. You know, it's kind of like when you look at, you know, the wiretapping scandal. Like, you know, part of me says, great, you know, if they can stop a terrorist, you know, before they blow something up that I'm in because they listen to a conversation, then hooray. And then on the other hand, it's kind of just,
I don't want them to listen to me, even though it's yeah. I mean, when they say, if you have, you know, if you aren't guilty of anything, you don't have anything to worry about. Okay. But still, like, there, you know, our rights are guaranteed. And one of those rights is the right to privacy. And
yeah, well, yeah,
you're suddenly taking that away unilaterally and without anybody, you know, being able to have any say to the contrary.
Is there actually a right to privacy somewhere? I mean, like, constitutionally or Bill of Rights or...
Well, yeah, maybe not, huh?
I mean, it seems like one of those things that has certainly been built into the American
culture. Well, I think it all falls under the Fourth Amendment right, is that, you know, they can't warrantlessly, search you, and I'd say listening into my phone conversation is like a warrantless search. You know, I think...
Is it, but it's not your prop... I mean, it's not like they're tapping into your phone. It's not like they're entering your property. They're doing it on a phone line that has no bearing, or, you know, no relation.
Yeah,
to you,
but the phone line is owned by a private organization.
But if they say it's okay.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Yeah, and this is actually something we were talking about with Google versus China, or Google in China, and, you know, everybody being against Google. And, and one of the things that you know, everybody's saying is, oh, well, they're going against their do no evil thing. And a friend of ours in Japan, Phoenix, made some really good points to the contrary of saying, like, hey, they're just following their bottom line. And it's a good point, actually, that they're a private entity, so they don't owe you anything. And, you know, to be honest, like, they don't even have to, like, you know, make anything available to anyone, you know. But
and Phoenix's point was they're not being evil. They're providing their service to a country that, you know, here, you know, previously, just by a few years ago, wouldn't have had that type of information at all. So the fact that they're doing a little bit, you know, it's like getting their foot in the door basically by abiding to the government's rules, but they're not doing evil, they're doing good, but partially, you know?
Yeah, and I kind of agreed by saying, you know, I went to a private school. And you know, it's very different from public school, where in a public school, you know, the constitution, like the rights that you're guaranteed in the constitution are very, you know, those are the rules that you follow. Like, you have a freedom of speech. You can say whatever you want, more or less, and that's protected. Nobody can censor you. But at a private school, you don't really have those rules because it's a little bit different. I mean, you do, but you can a lot more easily be censored or be expelled for saying the wrong thing or for doing the wrong thing. You can have your club shut down for you know, no good reason, simply because the powers that be, you know, disagree with what you're doing.
I believe the phrase is panties in a twist.
Panties in a twist, yes. Bind, isn't that the word?
Panties in a bind, yeah.
All knotted up.
Yeah.
But, you know, this somehow all ties back into smoking, and I lost the bridge a while back.
Yeah, somehow.
But one thing I was going to say is that, and I don't know, I have all these sort of idealistic views of where our country should go with really controversial things like abortion laws and handgun law, or gun laws in general, and smoking laws. And one of the ones is, for me, smoking laws, is that I think all pre-manufactured cigarettes should be illegal. Now, I don't think tobacco should be illegal. I don't think smoking should be illegal. I don't so much care about smoking in public places. I think it's very nice to be able to go into a bar and not have to think ahead of time, like, well, oh, that's the jacket I always wear when I go into a smoky place, so I'll wear that jacket, you know. Yeah. Whatever, but the idea is just that, you know, we always see cigarette butts all over the place, and, you know, you hear about, oh, there's like, what, fiberglass and stuff in the filters, and it takes it forever to, you know, decompose, and it just looks bad. Well, if all you had was papers and tobacco, and that's it, like, you know, people have to roll their own, and so just say all pre-manufactured cigarettes can no longer be sold.
Yeah.
Tobacco can be grown. You know, loose tobacco can be sold. Papers can be sold. That's fine. You know, hell, even like, you know, filters, roll your own filtered things, and all that can be sold. It's so, I mean, it's going to cut down on that, and it's going to make it more difficult for people to smoke, and like kids and stuff to start smoking. So you'll have healthier people who don't end up doing this. And I think it might dissuade a lot of people in that they don't want to put the work involved into it. And so they're just say fuck it, you know?
Precisely. You know, it's really interesting. Like, I was talking to a friend of mine in Spokane, actually, who is a smoker, and she was complaining, obviously, about the new law, and she was saying, you know, I kind of wish they would have just banned smoking in its entirety, but they make too much money off of me.
Right.
I mean, the amount of revenue that Washington State generates from, you know, the sin tax and the things that they that they apply to cigarette smoke is too, or not smoke, but the cigarettes themselves is too much to say no smoking at all. So they just make these, you know, these rules to try and control it.
You know, first of all, to finish the thought that I was just having is that we're not going to make it illegal, but we're going to make it hard. And I think that's what kind of what they need to do. But my boss at work, or my guy who was previously my supervisor, I'm now in a new position, and he's no longer my supervisor, and he smokes, and he said they'll never make it illegal because they'll lose too much money if do.
Yeah.
And I always had the idea, I was like, oh, well, you know, what else do Americans always want? And that's sugar. And so it's okay, well, let's just, you know, I mean, if you add a penny a pound to sugar, like, and charge everybody, you know, big corporations, whatever, it doesn't matter. Yeah. If you buy sugar, you're paying this tax, you know, don't give anyone a break on it. Oh my God, like, you'd make tons of money, and nobody would notice, really, because it would be such a small amount. I thought that was a brilliant idea. Come to find out, Americans pay like 8 or 12 cents more per pound of sugar than like other countries or something like that. I mean, it's we're already paying like way too much for our sugar. I didn't know this. So, well, there goes that idea out the window. And apparently, like, people are steamed up over this. Like, yeah. I didn't know.
We'll just start taxing Splenda or whatever.
Yeah. Right. No, don't do that.
Yeah. You know, like when you're talking about, you know, the amount of like cigarette butts and whatever you find on the ground. Yeah. Back in college, I was taking a Greyhound from Spokane to Seattle. And it was always interesting because every, you know, 45 minutes or an hour or whatever, the bus would stop. And people, like, as the bus, you know, slowed to a stop, right. people would just be, like, getting out of their seats already. And just, yeah, exactly. And they would all, like, run outside and just light up and just be like, oh, finally, I can smoke. And I just had this vision in my head of, like, you know, it would be very quick, little short film, you know, guys on a bus looking around, the bus is coming into a stop, people start getting out of their seats and clamoring toward the front, they all ran out of the bus, and the guy still sitting in his seat looks out on the side of the bus, and on the side of the bus there are all these like weapons of death, like you'd have handguns and nooses and bloody knives and all these things like strewn all over the sidewalk, and all these people would run out of the bus and just promptly kill themselves on the side of the road.
I actually think it'd be really funny if you had like a rogue bus driver who just like lets them all out and then shuts the doors and takes off.
Yeah, but it's like it's weird like looking around and seeing all this like cigarette paraphernalia littered all over the place. It's like, you know, ultimately it's going to kill you. Why not just, you know.
Sure.
Plus, it'd be just funny to have, like, 30 people inside of a bus just killing themselves in various
Everybody inside
ways.
The bus just sort of, like, looking out and shaking.
Like,
their
you know, eating the classic gas station beef jerky. Right. Like, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I always thought that was weird. Like, you know, when I was on the Greyhound, because I've ridden the Greyhound between Spokane and Seattle a few times before, and I was just like, wow. Glad I'm not a smoker. Or like when it snows in Spokane and it's like 2 degrees outside. Yeah. Glad I don't smoke.
Yeah. You know, speaking of funny Greyhound stories, randomly,
yeah.
I guess. Go ahead. I think it was like my first, and it wasn't my first, it was like my second trip. But anyway, it was like a 6-hour bus ride. And it was like nearing the end of the bus ride. We had stopped somewhere for one of the elongated like 15-minute breaks. And everybody has since gone back on the bus, and the bus driver like storms onto the bus. And, like, just, like, stares down the aisle and, like, points these two kids sort of near the back and is like, you were lucky that you did that in their restroom. If you had done that on the bus, you'd see your ass in the freeway. And he, like, sat down and started the bus and we started rolling away. And I was just like, what did they do?
Oh, my God.
And I don't think it was on the same trip. I think this was actually on my first Greyhound trip that, like, halfway through, a bunch of teenagers had gotten on the bus and gone into a little convenience store that we stopped at, picked up a bunch of bottles of cough syrup and were just drinking them in the back. The Greyhound
dumbasses.
Tracks.
Did you hear there were a bunch of kids in Spokane that, like, OD'd on cough syrup and had to be taken to the hospital?
Nice.
It's like, come on, how desperate are you?
Have you, you know, I'm sure this has been a well-talked about phenomenon, but it wasn't something that I really realized since I don't buy Sudafed on a daily basis, but I just recently went into a grocery store to pick up some Sudafed because I actually had a cold. Right. I mean, I know people don't buy Sudafed for that anymore.
Right.
But, and they make you, they take down your driver's license number and all this good stuff. Yep. I mean, I wonder what they do with that. I was thinking that maybe there's some database that they sync with at the end of the night or something.
Probably.
Because the fact that they weren't entering into a computer and were doing it by hand kind of makes the system useless as far as I'm concerned.
No. The idea is so that if you like go around to like a dozen stores and buy your maximum 3 packages or whatever it is you can buy, that the FBI comes and knocks on your door, or the, you know, ATF or the whoever comes and knocks on your door.
Okay, so like these lists are then sent in to some central agency and they compare driver's license numbers?
Right, so that if your driver's license shows up like 8 times in a day, then they can come and be like, cut it out or arrest you.
Why don't they just invest in some sort of like centralized database that they swipe your card or whatever and your number goes instantly into this thing? Because that way, if you go to another store, you can be like, you've already purchased like 4 packs today. I mean,
it was interesting. I actually saw a thing recently on, I think it was on PBS. They were talking about it. And, they were basically the gist of the show was like, how pointless all the measures we're taking against it are. You know, they're like,
yeah, oh, I mean, it's totally half-assed.
Like, well, yeah, it was like, oh, they came up with all these great ideas, and it seemed to be working for a long time until they realized that entire time people had been buying it in 3 times the volume from Canada.
Nice.
It was like, good job, guys.
Yeah.
Oh, and it started off as like the liquid was what people were buying, but then eventually they figured out like you could just buy the tablets, and so you'd find all the empty tablets. They were called Smurfs, I guess, were the people who'd go in, punch the tablets out, and then sell them to other people or something like that. And then, I guess for a while, at one point you had to like apply to get a permit, and they had to be able to make Sudafed or something like that, or some sort of Sufadrine based, chemicals or drugs. Well, when they first started doing this, they had such an influx in applicants that they just sort of started handing out provisional ones like right away, and then they would do the check later on.
Right.
So of course, all these people got temporary ones, made tons of it, and then disappeared before they could shut them down. Well, I guess some guys had gotten a local company who was legit and didn't know any better, not only to exclusively deal to them, but to actually make stuff that didn't have the coating on it, because they had to like burn off the coating or something like that. It was like easier for them to make the drug because there wasn't this coating they had to deal with. And it was just like, oh my God. So then later, of course, this company's like, what? We're in trouble.
Oh, Lord.
Oh my God.
You know, all of this for a drug that's made by ingesting the Sudafed and urinating into a bucket and then sitting it outside so that the uric acid evaporates and all you're left with is a powder. You know, it's like those really expensive coffee beans that have been crapped out by a cat or whatever the hell it is. It's not a cat. What animal is it?
It's like a tapir or some weird ass thing. Yeah, I mean, I want to try a cup just to see.
Well, yeah, I mean, you gotta try.
I don't want to pay for the cup. That's the thing.
You know, it's like when you go into a bar and like someone's like, I'll buy you a shot of Jaeger.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, all right. You know, if you're buying, I guess.
A round of single malts on that guy. Yeah. I'm not going to pay for that shit. It's like, they have for some reason I insist on buying the snotty expensive spices, even though they're like the same as the, like, the cheapo ones.
Yeah, right? The Walmart 5 spice.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I always thought about that. I'm like, is there really any difference? I was like, we were at the grocery store one time, and back in Cheney, we had a friend from the film school, because this is the thing, 30 to 50% of the people who graduate or flunk out of film school end up working at Safeway.
Or some.
In fact, Emily, who was previously in the film school, works at Safeway.
Yes, she does.
We were there, and there was another guy who was in the film class, and so we knew him, and he was a manager there, and we picked up a brand name gallon of milk, and he says, why are you buying that? I said, oh, I don't know, I've just always bought this brand, I like the brand, you know, I trust them, I guess, you know, whatever. He goes, but it's the exact same milk as cheapo brand. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, they come from the same farm and this one's $1 cheaper.
That's excellent.
And I was like, what? And he goes, I'll open a gallon and you can taste it. I was like, no, that I'll take your word for it if you say
that's
so.
That's funny. Yeah,
so now we buy cheap stuff because apparently it's all the same.
You're in there comparing the active ingredients in milk. Yeah. Really. That's really funny.
But there's one thing I found, that like, even between like name brand cereal and cheap cereal, I can't tell the difference.
No.
And actually there's one, I forget what it is. There's one type of cereal.
The marketing campaign is less for the cereal in the bag.
Well, then that's the thing. Like there was one, I think and I know it's the Frosted Mini Wheats versus the Frosted Mini Spooners.
Okay.
I actually like the Mini Spooners a lot better.
Yeah.
The Frosted Mini Wheats, I don't think they taste as good.
Yeah.
So there was, I don't know why.
No.
But yeah, so I thought that was interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same with like Gap and Banana Republic and Old Navy.
Right.
Like all the clothes are made in the same factory by the same workers, designed by the same people. It's just that, you know, for market influence, they've created like 3 separate, you know, price points essentially.
Well, and it all goes back to the Chivas Regal effect in that respect, at least. It's the, you know, the people who have more money to spend, well, they want to buy really high quality stuff. Well, no, you're all buying the same stuff.
Yeah, you're all buying exactly. Yeah.
It's just, you're spending more for it.
It's like that story we heard earlier today about the property in Costa Rica. A guy was trying to sell off some houses.
Like eco homes or something.
Yeah,
like
and he was trying to sell all these houses, and he had priced them at,
a very reasonable price.
You know, X dollars, and then he, you know, they weren't selling, and And so he hired a business manager to come in and take a look at things. And the guy said, well, you're selling them for too cheap. People who are looking online are going to see that price and assume that there's something wrong with it. So he raised his price by 3. So now he's selling his houses for 3x, and they sold, you know, almost immediately because people saw the price and assumed, well, they must be great because the price is high.
But then that pissed him off.
Yeah, and then it made the guy mad because it was just like a perfect example of American consumerism and how it's gone totally horribly wrong.
I accept your money, but I just want you to know
that you're a dumbass.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty funny, though. I mean, that's, yeah.
And actually, as a web designer, that's one of the things that I struggle with, too, is like, where do I set my price point? Because, you know, I don't want people to pay what they shouldn't, you know? Like, I think it's right. absurd for people to pay some of the prices they pay. Like, and actually, I have another friend of mine, he says, you know, you walk into a business, and a lot of times people expect to spend $10,000. They just think that's how much it's going to cost.
Yeah.
When really, to do it, it may only cost, like, $1,000 or $2,000, but you'll charge them, like, twice that. Because you can, because they expect to pay 10.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, but at the same time, you know, I don't want to fall prey to that. Like, well, why is it so cheap? You know?
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Because that's how much it actually costs to do it.
Yeah. Like, well, and it's, yeah, it, you know, it happens all the time. Like even, I mean, there are, like we do services at work, you know, to like work on people's machines that we, mm-hmm. you know, we used to do them for free. Like people could just walk in to the store and we'd take a look at whatever their problem was. Right. And then as soon as we started charging for it, people did it more often than when they weren't being charged for
Weird.
It. Yeah. Because like people have more respect for work if they're mm-hmm. paying for it, and they'll be more inclined
think it's a better job because they're paying.
Well, it's not even that, they'll be more inclined to like provide useful information and actually, mm-hmm. you know, ensure that it gets done correctly.
That's true, I suppose.
And then they're also like, it's a very bizarre phenomenon. But I mean, I've fallen prey to it myself.
Sure. Oh, sure. I mean, it's the you get what you pay for mentality.
Yeah.
Because that is, I mean, it's like any other stereotype. It exists for a reason.
But it's also, it's not even just like getting what you pay for, but there's also a certain amount of like, I don't know, like shared responsibility in something. Like if someone's just giving away labor or a good or, you know, whatever, if they're just giving it away to you, you can take that, and then if it fails, I don't really know if I'm articulating
well,
this correctly.
Like, it's like if it fails, you're like, oh well, it was free anyway.
Yeah, I guess that. Yeah.
There's no warranty that comes with it. There's no implied warranty because you haven't paid for
it. But yeah, especially if it's I guess this applies really for services. But if someone's giving it away and it doesn't work, then there is no incentive for you to make it work in the first place. Right. But if you're paying for it, then you'll be more inclined to
follow
through. To make it work. Right. Like, so, you know, if you're going to give away web design services, or, you know, if I'm going to give away like video editing services,
sure.
you know, if I'm like, well, I need your footage, you know, or you're like, I need your pros to go on the site. And you're like, well, it's free. It's on the bottom of my list. But if they're paying a relatively good amount of money for it, then you'll be at the top of their priority list, which will make the work end up being better.
Which isn't actually always true. One of my friends who charges a fair price, let's say.
Yeah.
Not fair as in like, gee, you and me split it half and half. That's fair. Like,
yeah.
Like a fair price for his sites. He has some clients that he's had for over a year, and they don't understand, like, it's seriously going to take you, like, 20 minutes. You sit down, you write some crap, and you give it to me, and your site will be done.
Yeah.
If their sites have been done, they just don't write the copy. And then they get all mad. They're like, well, how come you haven't finished my site? It's like, it is done. You need to do this.
Yeah.
You need to write that. Well, how come you can't do it? Because I'm a web designer, not a, you know, insert your profession here. I don't know what you do. Like,
yeah. Well, then that's the balance. If you charge too much, people will assume you can do everything. But if you don't charge enough, then they won't care about getting you the information.
This is also something I've often said about, like, concerts and sporting events and stuff like that. Like, tickets to the Super Bowl were, like, how much? Like $1,500 each or something?
Like
it was
that. Well, yeah, like
ridiculous.
Yeah,
and
of course
they're
being eBayed and whatever
for like
more,
yeah, 3 times. I mean, it's absurd. Like, I'm sorry, but $50 to go see one person in concert, forget it. I mean, it's not worth it.
I mean, you're talking to the guy who just paid $300 to see Coldplay, so.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were fourth row seats, so it was pretty cool.
But. Well, that's a little better, but yeah. I mean, it's just, it's, the problem though is that they don't need that much money. They need maybe like $100 to cover all of their from each person, maybe to cover all their costs. $300 from each person, like
yeah,
it's because we're going to pay it. That's
right,
why.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
yeah.
And I don't know, but then people be like, oh my God, okay, $300 for a ticket, that's ridiculous. Well, why are you paying it, man? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's people can never work together. Like, it's one of those things, like, they'd change it if everyone would boycott it. Well,
yeah.
There are people who just can't live without it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's also interesting, like, something that I've... something that I've just, like, sort of recently come to, like, terms with internally to myself. It's like, you know, before it was always like, well, why do the people who have more money, why do they get to, you know, why do they have all the advantages in life? And and now that I'm, like, you know, working for my own personal gain, it's like, well, yeah, I made more money, so I should be entitled. Well, not, in, you know, but I can afford this, so I'm going to take advantage of it. And
right. But and, I think really that applies more to, like, the people who are born rich and don't really have to earn it, don't have to work for it, you know? Yeah. I mean, and I was thinking about that. I was like, geez, if we won the lottery, I'd never have to work again because, well, I wouldn't spend too frivolously. I mean, sure, I'd spend kind of frivolously. Who would?
Well, you gotta.
You I have mean, to, yeah. You know, I'd buy a car I don't need. Sure, I'd buy a house someplace I don't ever visit, but,
yeah,
you know. But at the same time, I'd invest a lot of it so that that money continues to grow and I always have that to fall back on. So it's like, you know, I wouldn't have to earn it after that point. That's not really fair. Like, even from a standpoint of, gee, I have all this money, I would think that's not very fair.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd actually quit my job altogether because, A, that's a horrible work ethic to show your children.
You know. But, well, I mean, you know, I would hope that you would quit your job and then
quit
something.
My current job.
Yeah. And then, and then do something.
But I'd do something else.
Yeah.
You know,
That's always.
You know, I'd work for myself full time is what
I'd do. Precisely. Precisely. Yeah. I mean, that's like every time.
You know, I'd make my feature length film
about
whatever I want because I don't have a studio to answer to.
Yeah. Every time my wife and I are like, oh, man, we could win the lottery. Like, it's our first thought. It's weird. It's never like, oh, I could buy a house or, like, you know, a boat. It's always like, oh, we could totally make a movie.
Yeah.
It's really funny. But it's kind of weird though, like, when you have that realization where it's like, if you're pitted up against somebody else and you happen to get the advantage because you had more money than them and you're like, yeah, damn right, you know, I worked for that and I had it. It's kind of like disturbing internally because you're like, oh Christ, I literally like measured human beings on a function of how much money they have.
Mm.
Ew. It's really like dirty feeling. You want to take a shower, but at the same time you're like, yeah, but I got the better seat. But it was weird because like when we were at the concert, like we got the tickets because it was an auction. And so like, obviously the more money that like you basically, you just put money into this pool.
Right.
And then depending what other people bet would determine what seat you got. So like, you know, if the highest, like we put in $150 per ticket. If somebody
so else, it was like a bell curve almost.
I guess. Well,
in a weird sort of way.
No.
Okay,
wasn't.
I was totally wrong.
No, it was just a linear regression. Like, and then if somebody else was like, "Well, I'm willing to pay $600 a ticket," and they did that, then like they would obviously get the first seat, and the person who's paying $500 a ticket, whatever. So like there was this little section of the people who had won in the auction, and then like all around were just like the people who could just naturally pay whatever Ticketmaster was asking for those seats, which was like even higher. And I was just looking at these people and like, I don't know. They didn't seem like better people. So I was like, why are they rich? And the people were like, you know, this guy was having a conversation with the dude sitting next to me. He's like, oh, I'm the director of blah, 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 some like medical place. And you know, it's just like all of their self-worth was determined by their wealth. And it was just weird. But at the same time, I was like, but we had enough to pay for these tickets too. So suck it, person behind us. And it
but I think there's always that feeling of like a really good feeling to being able to treat yourself to something.
Yeah.
You know, like I know I've always felt that way. And when there's something I want and I finally have the money to buy it, like when I bought the new laptop, it was great because, hey, I've got a job. I have the money to purchase this. I'm comfortable. Like, I don't need to worry. Like, oh, gee, maybe I'll have to skimp on this or something.
Yeah,
you know, I knew I had the money to make the payments to make it work. And I don't know, there's just a certain feeling of pride. But I think that comes from not just having the money, but having earned the money.
Right, exactly. You know,
I think there's still a feeling of, like, elation in being able to buy it. Like, if you did win the lottery, oh, I could buy my Bugatti because I can afford it. You know, a million euro car. But, you know, it wouldn't be a sense of pride necessarily, just a sense of like, hey, cool, I got the car I wanted.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to describe it. It's like pride versus
versus just joy.
Or, yeah, just like instant gratification.
Yeah.
Yeah, gratification versus pride.
Yeah, there you go.
Something deeper in pride.
Yeah. Well, we want everyone to keep that in mind as we wrap up Allopod this month.
Hey, sweet.
Yeah. Ended on some sort of cohesive note for once.
Yeah.
Look at that. Maybe I should do interviews first from now on. Well, we always have that wrap up at the end. Anyway, so Chris, thank you for joining me and helping me out with this month.
Yeah.
We finally found something to talk about. What the audience didn't hear was it's the 30 minutes of us talking about all this crap. What they didn't hear was the 2.5 hours of us going, what are we going to talk about?
There were lots of noises like, trying to figure out what the hell to talk about.
In fact, at one point it was suggested that we do 30 minutes of just those noises.
Yes.
So.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah.
That'll be for the conceptual episode of Allopod.
We should do like episodes with like different styles of art. Avant-garde and Dadaist and stuff. Yeah. Weird things like that.
Yeah, exactly. You just have an episode of silence.
There we go. John Cage would be proud.
Yes, he would.
That's two episodes in a row we've mentioned John Cage, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we'll be on a roll now. Should be getting some kickbacks here.
That's right. It's the most popularity he's had since...
ever.
Yeah. Because nine of us went to music school,
really.
This is odd.
Anyway, we've ruined any cohesive ending that we established.
That's right.
But, that's the way it goes with Allopod. Chris, thanks for letting me... for joining me rather here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure we'll have you again at some point. Have you on again?
Yes.
You can tell it's late. I can't get a word out or sentence out properly. See what I mean? No. I'm Thomas J. Brown.
And I'm Chris Bustet.
You've been listening to Allopod. No.